This morning I'm going to be sharing my recollections of a conversation that I had with a guest I recently invited for dinner, Nicholas Copernicus. Born in Poland in 1473, he lived until 1543 and he died at the age of 70. Copernicus is what we refer to as a polymath, someone who's accomplished in numerous diverse subjects. He had a doctoral degree in canon law or Catholic Church law. He was a mathematician, an astronomer, a physician, a politician, a translator, a diplomat, and an economist. And these were not just fields of interest. He studied these subjects at prestigious European universities, earning numerous degrees, and he was a practitioner also in all these fields. When he was 44 years old, he developed a key concept in economics called the quantity theory of money, which is still in use today. This was in 1517. If Nobel Prizes had been awarded in the 16th century, Copernicus would likely have several. He was the embodiment of a tenet of Renaissance humanism that people are limitless in their capacity for development, and they should embrace all knowledge and develop their capacities as fully as possible. Copernicus was also multilingual, so although his native tongue was Polish, or what was spoken in Poland at the time, he was fluent in German, Greek, and Latin, and we were able to converse quite easily in English. So how was I able to have a conversation over dinner, you may ask, with a man who died more than 500 years before I was born? Time travel. The year of our meeting was 1542, about a year before his death, he was 69. Now, this is a recollection of our conversation. It might not be 100% accurate, but I think it's pretty close. The first thing that struck me about Nico, and I'm going to call him Nico in this recollection because that's what he preferred to be called. The first thing that struck me was his curiosity about all things. When I asked him to meet me for dinner, I didn't divulge that I was from the future, but upon my arrival, I felt obliged to tell him where and when I was from. He, of course, had no idea that 500 years hence, the most powerful country in the world was this place called the United States of America, and that it had thrived for 250 years under a messy form of government called democracy. He wanted to know all about how that worked, how we kept things in balance for so long, and whether I thought we could continue to thrive. My answer was, perhaps. I told Nico that humans had set foot on the moon. He didn't seem too surprised by that. But he was surprised that we had not yet visited other planets. And he seemed to do some math in his head, and he nodded knowingly. The distance required to reach those planets is vast, and the time the journey would take, long. He asked me about advances in medicine, about politics, about international relationships, about our 21st century economy and modern technology. My memories and descriptions were weak, to say the least. He seemed both disappointed and empathetic to my struggles, understanding that not everyone has his intellectual capacity, least of all me. As you saw in the clip, and most of that was actually pretty accurate, he was not only a Catholic, but a church canon, a church bureaucrat, as they said in the clip. So it was natural that our conversation turned to religion. He asked me about my beliefs. I told him that I was a Unitarian Universalist. He looked puzzled. And I explained that UUism was formed by the consolidation of two distinct Christian traditions, Unitarians, who emphasized the oneness of God and humanity of Jesus, and Universalists, who reject the concept of eternal damnation, believing in universal salvation and a God whose love is too vast to condemn anyone. I further explained that in the 21st century, UUism is pluralistic. Members include people of diverse backgrounds and varying spiritual beliefs, including humanists, agnostics, atheists, Christians, pagans, and Buddhists, just to name a few. Did we have a holy book like the Bible or Torah or Quran, he asked. No, I said, we have no dogma, but a set of six values that all UU congregations agree to support. And our individual church has a covenant, an agreement for how we would be with each other. He asked me to cite the covenant. I said, as you all said earlier today, love is the spirit of this church. The quest for truth is its sacrament. And he smiled broadly. Truth indeed, he said. I continue to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in freedom, and to help our neighbor to these ends we covenant one with another. To seek the truth in freedom, that is what my entire life has been about, he said. And your values? I was kind of expecting a question like this, so I brought with me on my time travel journey a copy of the UU values. I recited them to him, and I'll repeat them in full here, as I think all of us could use a reminder. Interdependence, honoring the interdependent web of all existence and our place within it. Pluralism, celebrating that we are sacred beings, diverse in culture, experience, and theology. Justice, working to build a diverse, multicultural, beloved communities where everyone thrives. Transformation, adapting to a changing world and committing to continual spiritual and ethical growth. Generosity, cultivating a spirit of gratitude, hope, and compassion. And equity, declaring that every person is inherently worthy and has the right to flourish with dignity. When I finished, Nico sat quietly for a minute, thinking, making connections in his mind. It's beautiful, he finally said. It seems that your values have love at the center. Perhaps if I were born in another time and place, I would be a Unitarian Universalist. Finally, the moment arrived that I had long been anticipating, the opportunity to ask him so many questions I had about his life, his beliefs, his decisions. We were way past the point of small talk, so I jumped right in with the big question. You, a devout Catholic, a student of the Bible, were the first to postulate that the earth may not be the center of the universe. How could you reach that conclusion and still remain true to the teachings of the church? He began his response with a gentle correction. I was not the first to suggest that the earth may not be the center of the universe. As I have recently found out, a Greek astronomer named Aristarchus postulated the same thing nearly 1700 years before I was born, 250 years before the birth of Christ. And several Islamic astronomers developed similar theories about 500 years ago. I was not aware of this previous work when I reached my own conclusions, but I cannot claim to be the first. He continued, "You infer that I was faced with a great decision. Do I continue to follow my faith, or do I follow the facts that seem to contradict my faith? Am I a man of faith or a man of science? I will tell you that I see no inherent contradiction between the two. I can be both, but it can be tricky. Let me explain. The Bible indicates in numerous passages that the earth is the center of all that is, beginning with the creation story in Genesis. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. So you see right there in the very first verses, the Bible implies that the sun was created to give light to the earth, that the creation of the earth was the main event. And a bit further into that chapter, he continued, verses 14 through 18 to be exact. And God said, "Let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens," or the sky, "to separate the day from the night." And God made two great lights, the greater light, the sun, to rule the day, and the lesser light, the moon, to rule the night. He made the stars also. And God set them in the firmament of the heavens to give light upon the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. Again, he says, Genesis places the earth at the center of creation, and the sun, moon, and stars in service, if you will, to the earth. And then he continued. Later in the Bible, in the book of Joshua, there's a passage that many have claimed affirms that the sun revolves around the earth. Joshua asked God to delay nightfall to give Israel an advantage over an enemy. And the passage says, So the sun stood still, and the moon stopped. The sun stopped in the middle of the sky and delayed going down for about a full day. I could go on, he said, but I think you get my point. Throughout the Bible, the holiest of books, the source of truth, the earth is at the center, and the sun and the moon and the stars travel across the earth's sky. And continuing, he said, these are the teachings that I grew up with, that were ingrained in me from an early age. But as I grew older, I reached the conclusion that the Bible is not intended to be interpreted literally in its entirety. I jumped to agreement. Yes, the Bible has wonderful stories, some historically accurate, provable, and some not so much. Many of the passages were written decades or centuries after they supposedly occurred. And then the transcripts were translated into many languages by humans that made judgments, mistakes, and sometimes intentional decisions designed to build a strong church, right? I suppose so, Nichols said. While many of the stories have lessons for all of us on how to live a fulfilling life of service, treating each passage literally is a mistake. He went on. My initial interest in astronomy was not to disprove anything, and certainly not the teachings of the most important institution in my life. I just wanted to understand and then share how it all worked, how God's creation was made real. I believe that comprehending God's wisdom and majesty through his laws of nature is a devout form of worship. And I think that my work reveals that the universe is a mathematical marvel of a perfect creator. And understanding his math lets us appreciate even more that God's creation is a marvel, a miracle, a divine creation. But, he said, not everyone sees it that way. For many, more importantly than explaining the motions of celestial bodies and what revolves around what, my work challenges the very essence of humankind. God created us in his image. God gave us dominion over all life. He sent his only son down to earth to save us from sin. God answers our prayers. How could we not be the center of his attention, the center of his creation? If that isn't the case, what does it mean to who we are? And he said, not incidentally, my work, my science could undermine the reputation and the credibility of the Catholic Church as the source of truth. Institutional and individual power is at stake, and when power is threatened, you can expect some pushback, to say the least. I asked him, is that why you've not published your findings? Because you're concerned about the reaction of the church? Well, let's be clear, he said, nearly 30 years ago, I briefly described my ideas about the sun-centered universe. I called the document Commentariolus, or Little Commentary in English. It contained the basic assumptions of my hypothesis, but didn't go into describing the numerous celestial observations and the complicated mathematics that would prove my theory. I gave that to a few of my friends, and they gave it to some of their friends, but it didn't get much attention. And then I've continued to gather data to support my ideas, and I've now developed a comprehensive treatise that is scientifically defensible. In fact, the manuscript is finished and has been sitting on my desk for the last 10 years. Its title is On the Revolutions of the Celestial Spheres. It is, I must say, revolutionary. And I thought to myself, well, there it is, the world's first dad joke. And why have you not published it? I asked again. He sighed. Well, it's complicated. My friends have urged me to publish it, but I'm a loyal Catholic, as well as a scientist. I have not wished to risk the scorn from the church and from my friends and from my colleagues, to which I would expose myself if I were to publicize my work. It's not the challenge to the science that I'm concerned about. After all, that's what discovery is all about. No, more difficult than debating facts and figures is casting doubt on deeply held beliefs. Millions and millions of people believe that this Earth is the center of the universe, of all creation. How will a heliocentric model of the universe, where the sun, not the Earth, is at the center, affect how they understand who they are, and how they see the reason for being, how they see their life in this world and the next? In addition to challenging beliefs, my treatise will challenge power, and people in power want to stay in power. What if loyal Catholics suddenly realize that much of what they've been told is not based on the truth? How many will turn away from the church? And when they do, what will happen to the authority, influence, and power of those in the church echelon? Those in power don't want to find out. And frankly, I love the church. In addition to saving souls, it does many good works for those who need its charity. So he said, for 10 years, I've been sitting on the fence trying to decide if and when I should publish. I am now an old man. I think the end of my time on earth is near. I think now might be the time to set my worries aside and let the truth be told. But I am concerned about the reaction of the church. So I have a question for you, my time traveler. Is there anything I should do to get Pope Paul III's support for my work? It took me a minute to absorb the fact that Nicholas Copernicus was asking me for advice. I thought for a minute about how our current leaders, and one in particular, is influenced. Well, maybe you could write a dedication of the book to the Pope. Tell him what a great guy he is, how you admire his leadership for his ongoing support for the arts and sciences. Flatter him a bit. I'd give that a try. Well, it feels a little manipulative, he said, but it might work. And that, in fact, is exactly what happened. Copernicus published on the revolutions of the celestial sphere shortly before he died. It included a dedication to the Pope, and for decades, the Catholic Church not only tolerated his theories, but actually taught them in their universities. The mention of the end of Nico's life and his new resolve to publish his work got him wondering about his legacy. So tell me, my visitor from the future, how does this play out? Is my work accepted by the scientific community, by the church, by the common person? Is it the beginning of the end of the Catholic Church? Does anyone take my work to the next stage? I responded, your calculations and conclusions about the Earth and other planets orbiting the sun are accurate, though in a few years your model will be refined to reflect elliptical orbits rather than circular. A guy named Galileo Galilei confirmed much of your work with powerful telescopes, and the Catholic Church convicted him of blasphemy. Nico found this curious and wondered aloud why the church tolerated his idea, but not Galileo's, the flattery of the Pope notwithstanding. I told him that in the next century, Isaac Newton would develop the law of gravity, which unified terrestrial or earth-based and celestial or sky-based mechanics. He seemed very happy that much of his work was indeed supported by further experiments, measurements, and calculations, and that scientific discovery in this area continued. I also told him that astronomers now know that his model was incomplete. The sun is not the center of the universe. Our solar system, that group of planets that orbit our sun, as the kids nailed this morning, the solar system is the solar system. Our solar system is just one tiny part of a massive universe that contains billions of stars and suns and millions of solar systems. He asked me how big scientists think the universe is and where is its center. And he was disappointed when I just shrugged my shoulders. And the church, he asked? Well, that's a bit more complicated, I began. Initially, the Catholic Church had no official position on your theory, but early on, you had your doubters. A guy named Tolosani made it his mission to discredit your work just a couple years after you passed. And his denunciation was written in his book that was titled on the truth of sacred scripture. He called Copernicanism, as it became to be known, absurd because it was scientifically unproven. He said your thought process was backwards, that you'd come up with the idea first and then sought evidence that would confirm it. And he said that mathematical numbers in general were a mere product of the intellect without any physical reality, and as such could not provide physical causes in the investigation of nature. Fortunately, I said, his views didn't get much traction with church leaders, and for the much of the next 60 years, your book will be taught at Catholic universities. And I continued, Protestants, however, were a different story. Instead of challenging the science itself, they took the tack that your theories conflict with biblical passages and therefore cannot be the truth. Even Martin Luther himself opposed your conclusions on the basis that they were not consistent with the Bible. Eventually, the Catholics aligned with the Protestants on your heliocentric model, I said. In 1616, 74 years from now, the church issues a decree suspending your book from general use. We would now call that a book ban. And then came Galileo. He supported and advanced your theories, and the church had had enough. As I said, he was tried and convicted by the church of heresy and spent the last days of his life under house arrest. It took more than 200 years. It took more than 200 years for the Catholic Church to drop your treatise from its banned book list. Wow, he said, 200 years. And what about in your time, the 21st century? I said, most of what you published is considered settled science. At a young age, as we saw this morning, children are taught that the earth revolves around the sun, that the moon revolves around the earth, and that there are billions of stars just like our sun in the vast universe. Whether there are other planets like Earth somewhere in the universe is still an open question. And some scientists have dedicated their lives to finding that answer. Nico was pleased. So scientific discovery and the quest for truth persists across the centuries. And people all around the world can seek their own truth in freedom, just as your covenant states. Well, the answer to that question is complicated. Perhaps another dinner is required to discuss that one. And with that, I took my leave, still in awe at the opportunity to have a conversation over dinner with Nicholas Copernicus, one of the greatest minds the world has ever known, a man who changed, eventually, how we think, how we all think about our place in the universe. Amen.